Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensics Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with Bob Lee, a veteran state game warden who served in Florida for 30 years. Bob Lee began his career as a Florida state game warden in 1977 under the auspices of what was then the Florida Game and Freshwater Fish Commission. 22 years later, in 1999, that agency merged with the Florida Marine Patrol to form the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, where Bob continued to work until he retired in 2007. The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission has about 725 sworn law enforcement officers. From what Bob can tell, it's the largest state conservation agency in the United States. By comparison, California actually has the lowest ratio of game wardens to population in all of North America, with its Department of Fish and Game having only 240 field-level game wardens, but twice the population at 37 million. Like other state game wildlife agencies, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission enforces rules to protect the state's fish and wildlife and to keep waterways safe for millions of boaters. Its law enforcement officers are often among the first on the scene to help when natural disasters occur. They are also often the sole law enforcement presence in many remote parts of the state. Veteran agent Bob Lee was first stationed in Putnam County in northeast Florida, where he remained for his entire 30-year career. He worked the St. Johns River for 12 years before being promoted to lieutenant and then extending his reach to Putnam, St. Johns, and Flagler counties. As you'll hear, Bob has patrolled many of Florida's inshore and offshore wilderness areas and experienced a multitude of high-speed boat chases and hair-raising adventures, some of which you'll hear in this interview. When we spoke, I asked Bob to give me some background on Florida's State Wildlife Agency and also on how he became an agent.
To give you a little more backstory first, I was hired initially by the Game and Freshwater Fish Commission, and there were two agencies at that time responsible for conservation enforcement in the state of Florida. It was the Game and Fish Commission, and then it was the Florida Marine Patrol who were responsible for marine species. Then in July 1st of 1999,
and the Game Commission was for land-based things.
The Game Commission was for enforcement of or in protection of freshwater fish and game, and inland wildlife, and we did boating safety work. The Marine Patrol was for protection of marine species, boating safety. They'd work drug runners coming in off the coast, that sort of thing, and we are also state certified law enforcement officers, just like your highway patrol, beverage agents, and so forth.
Okay.
And so now, the years go along, and in July 1st of 1999, these two organizations, the Florida Marine Patrol and the Game and Freshwater Fish Commission, merged to form one. And then that new agency was called the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. The reason for the merger was because the old Game Commission had constitutional authority to make laws to protect freshwater fish and wildlife. The old Marine Patrol did not. Their laws had to be run through the Florida legislature. And so once that happens, it was open to attack by special interest groups any laws they wanted to propose, particularly the commercial fishing lobby. And so over the years, the outdoorsmen in Florida, they realized the benefit of the way we did it. Our biologists recommended changes based on the scientific method and also from suggestions from law enforcement. It went to this commission of what I believe was five persons with the old Game and Freshwater Fish Commission. And when they passed that law, it went into law, and the legislature couldn't do anything about it. It's a very efficient process. So when the new agency was formed, we now have seven members on the commission. It's basically the same process, and it's rather efficient, and it's not open, where it's less open to attack from special interest groups. Let's put it that way.
And who is on the commission? Are they appointed by the governor?
Yeah, they're appointed by the governor. Yes, they're usually influential people throughout the state who have a you know, businessmen and women who have a sincere interest in the outdoors and have a background in the outdoors.
And is there usually a member of the public, or are they all politically connected, or?
They're a member of the public, but I would have to say they have some connections politically as well. But they're sharp people, and they have the better, you know, they have the interest for the state of Florida at heart. I don't know that a citizen who didn't have any political connections could really get there, to be honest with you. And their terms run, if I'm not mistaken, for about 5 years.
And so what is the process for the law? Does that come up through the agency?
Actually, there's a couple of processes. One is from within the agency, and often our biologists, marine biologists, freshwater fish biologists, game biologists, we've got a lot of biologists that work for us. They will recommend a law, and there's a form to be filled out, suggestions for law, and these go up through the chain of command, and then within the organization, and then if at the very top in headquarters feel like, okay, we need to do this, they'll submit that proposal to the commissioners, and then they will vote on it to see whether they want to do it or not. And of course, those people that are recommending it, usually there's a higher up with, let's just say it's freshwater fish, there'll usually be somebody out of Tallahassee within the Division of Freshwater Fisheries that will be there to recommend that change to the commissioners. I'll just use that as an example. Also, the general public can also recommend changes, and we have forms for that. And that's done on a two-year basis, a two-year cycle. And so let's just say they feel that there's a law that's frivolous. It has no meaning. And we still have some of those on the books. They'll make a recommendation. It'll go through the biologist. They'll make their recommendations. So there's a whole process, several-tier process where it gets eventually to headquarters. And then if they think that it's good, that is reasonable, they'll submit that to the commissioners for their approval or not.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. It's a very good process. It really is. And because for many years, well, to give you more of a backstory with the old Game and Freshwater Fish Commission, which was formed around 1942 or 1943, the commercial freshwater fishing lobby, we were attacked time and time again. And they brought to referendum of the people to have that constitutional authority taken away. The commercial fishing lobby did four times over the history of the Game and Freshwater Fish Commission. It went to the vote of the public, and they rejected it. So that goes to show you that the public realized the value of the constitutional authority to have that ability to make laws for the protection of, fish and wildlife.
Do you know of any other state that runs like that?
No, I don't. I haven't done any research on it. It would be interesting to find out. I suspect that there's probably not very many that do it that way.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Because most of the time, I think you're going to have to run through the state legislature.
Yeah.
That's a long...
That's a long process.
Exactly.
And right. So what is the role of the legislature then in the commission?
Well, the authority of the commissioners does not extend to license fees, for instance. And so if the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission wanted a license fee upgrade, a higher price for a saltwater fishing license, they would have to put that recommendation before the legislature. Also, any laws involving boating safety, all that has to be funneled through the legislature. And of course, listeners out there that don't know, this agency now, the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission, basically they've got two main objectives. One is the enforcement of boating safety laws, which is basically like being a traffic cop or highway patrolman on the water, to put it simply. And the second one is protection for is resource protection, protection of all freshwater, saltwater, wildlife, game, non-game species. It's really quite broad what we do as an agency, and very And here in Florida, we deal with very complex issues. You go to the south end of the state, it's almost like a jungle-like environment, and then in the north end of the state, it's almost like being in Georgia, you know, because it's got a rolling hill and cooler temperature. So, and there's a lot of transitions there for many different species that we have to protect. So.
And so where were you first stationed? You had mentioned Putnam County?
Right. Well, and I stayed there my whole career. And Putnam County is in northeast Florida. It's about an hour and a half south of Jacksonville. And it's split in half by the St. John's River. And again, for your listeners that don't realize it, the St. John's River is a huge river. It's 273 miles. And interestingly, it runs from south to north. Most rivers run from north to south.
So this runs from south to north?
That's correct. And so that's kind of an interesting take on that river. Like I said, most of them run, as you probably know, opposite to that. The river is quite large, has many tributaries, many large lakes. Within the St. John's River, just south of me, is Lake George, which is really a giant bulge in the river. And that is 46,000 acres in size with a 50-mile circumference. And it is the second largest inland lake in Florida to Okeechobee. Okeechobee, of course, is huge. It's about 500 and some odd thousand acres, the second largest, I think, inland freshwater lake in the United States, if I've got it right. But anyway, within the United States. So we have a lot of water area here, but the river itself can be, easily a couple miles wide north of Palatka, and in Lake George itself, it's about 6 miles wide. So the waters we have here are many and large, and so we have a lot of people that go out to enjoy that and do fishing, and of course we have to go out there and check them, make sure they are in compliance.
And what kind of species are around in and around the river?
Well, I mean, you've got here in the river, it dumps out into the Atlantic Ocean, and so we have many saltwater species that come up here. We have redfish, we actually have tarpon, a few flounder, but mainly when people fish the river here, it's they're after freshwater fish. Of course, the largemouth bass is that's the premier freshwater game fish in Florida, and we have a lot of those here, and they're and that's a very sought after species by freshwater sportsmen. We've got a plethora of manatees here, right down from my house here. I can go right now, since this is wintertime, I can go down to Wilaka Springs, which is a very small springs that flows out into the St. John's, and there'll be 20 to 25 manatees right now as we speak, lulling around in that water, because the water temperature has now gotten so cold they can't tolerate it, and they have to go to the warmer spring water to survive in the wintertime. And so those are great things for boaters to see, or anybody who's interested in wildlife. We've got bald eagles, a lot of bald eagles along the river, just many things. In the late summer, we usually have a shrimp run here in the river. This year, for instance, I went out down in Wilaka, which is a small town just down from my house on the river, and I caught shrimp that were 7 to 8 inches long.
Really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So there's just wonderful opportunities for the sportsmen. Also in the river are striped bass and hybrid, and sunshine bass, which are hybrid fish, a cross between the white bass and the striped bass. And these are all stock fish. The striped bass does not reproduce naturally in the St. John's River system anymore. At one time it did in the Ocklawaha River, which is fed by Silver Springs, but now since they put in Robin Dam, it really prevents the fish from being able to spawn, because their eggs require 72 hours of suspended motion in clear flowing water. And as a result of the dam, we don't have that anymore. But we do have the fish. It's a stock species. They don't get up near as large as they do on the northeast Atlantic coast because of the warmer water. They usually live for about 6 years. The biggest fish maybe get 15, 18 pounds, and then they die. They don't tolerate a water temperature well of above 80 degrees. So once it gets above 80 degrees, they do the reverse of what the manatees do. In the summertime, they go to the cooler waters, whereas the manatees leave the spring to go out into the warmer waters. And so these striped bass and sunshine bass will hoover, and they'll stay within those springs until it gets cool enough for them to go back out into the river again.
Oh, interesting. And so what, from a law enforcement perspective, what are the main wildlife-related issues that you see? Is it overfishing?
Well, when I first came here in 1977 to the St. John's River, I was assigned to river patrol. And the objective, and it was a new crew of six officers that had just been formed. And the reason why that crew was formed was to quell the illegal commercial fishing. It was out of control. And we at that time, they were doing everything. Illegal gill netting, wire traps, hoop nets, monkey fishing, which is the electrocution of catfish. Every kind of illegal commercial fishing you can imagine was going on. And so it was, to use a well-worn cliche, a target-rich environment. And frankly, I had a ball, and particularly dealing with the monkey fishermen, because they use these electric devices that are homemade to shock the fish. There would always be a high-speed boat chase. They had very fast. They had very small boats with very big engines, and we basically had the same craft to chase them with. And so, if you're a young man about the age of 23 or 24, you know you enjoy some good sport. Well, I had plenty of it.
So, tell me about one of your cases.
Well, I'll share. I've had a lot of boat chases, but one I'll share didn't involve a monkey fishing, but. Monkey fishermen, but it was kind of interesting how it came about and what happened. And this was probably 10 years after I got here, just before I was fixing to promote and leave the river. But one day I was in the Ocklawaha River. First of all, I got to do a little backstory. The Ocklawaha River, for your listeners out there, is it's like going into a subtropical jungle, almost a rainforest environment. You've got this clear flowing water, many, many side creeks and small tributaries that finger off of it and kind of spider web away from it. And you've got herons and moss and sometimes monkeys even swinging through the trees that escape from Silver Springs. So that's the kind of place this is. It's really a beautiful river. But anyway, about noon one day, I was underneath the Highway 19 bridge and I was checking a husband and wife, and neither one of them had a fishing license. And so I said, I asked the husband, I said, would you like my special marriage discount? And he said, well, what do you mean? He says, well, when you're married, I only cite one of you rather than two. I mean, after all, it does come out of the same pocket. And of course, he did. Oh, yes, officer, I want your special marriage discount. So I was in the process of writing him the one citation for the both of them, really. Excuse me. And I hear the sound of a small engine, or I hear the sound of an engine chugging away back in the swamp. And I realized it was going to come out from a side creek just down from where I was sitting. And so as I'm writing the citation, I'm tracking the noise with my ears. And as the boat comes out, I stop writing the citation and I look at it. And it's about a 13-foot wooden vessel. It's called a Myron War. And these boats were specially made for the commercial fishermen to run from the game warden because they have a tremendous hole shot, which means they can get up real quick and out of the water because it's a flat-bottom wooden boat. And it had about an 80-horsepower engine on it. And I watched them. They didn't see me for some reason, but I was probably 40 yards away from them up against the bank. And so now I'm watching them. The guy throws out a trap drag, which is a drag used to bring to drag up wire traps or crab traps. And so he dragged up this line that had crab traps attached to it. The problem was I knew he didn't own the crab traps. Here in Florida, it's a third-degree felony to run somebody else's crab traps. So I knew if he emptied that trap into the boat, he would have committed a third-degree felony.
How did you know they weren't his traps?
Because I knew the owner of the trap.
Oh, okay.
When you work these areas like this, Laurel, after a number of years, you know every commercial fisherman and where all their traps and sets are. So, I mean, but that takes, of course, a period of time. But you learn to know that. That's part of your patrol area. So when that line came up and I looked at him, I said, "Nope, wrong guy. Wrong boat." I said, "He's fixing to commit a felony if he empties the trap out." So I sat there, I'm watching him, and he just got the line in his hand when he looked up and saw me. And when I saw that expression I was all too familiar with by then, an expression across his forehead said rabbit. He dropped the line, jumped in the seat of the boat, cranked the engine, and off he went. And so I took off after him. And I had a fairly small bass boat, a low, very low-profile bass boat, a 17-foot bass boat with 150-horsepower Mercury outboard on it. It was a real quick boat, could handle it, and could handle the turns like a Grand Prix race car at the Monte Carlo Speedway. I mean, it was a really very maneuverable boat and quite quick. And so I had no problem really staying behind him in the open part of the Okawaha. But I'm wondering in the back of my mind, really, why is he running? Because to that point, he really hasn't committed the crime I can charge him with. But he's running for all he's worth, and this little boat was like a go-kart, like a go-kart on steroids. That he, I mean, yeah, because he's just hugging the shore. He's just whipping in and out, and I'm thinking, well, you know, that's really quite maneuverable. Now we're heading upstream in this creek, and about 6 miles upstream, I know, is Robin Dam. He can't go any farther than that. That's the end point. His boat cannot get across Robin Dam, and neither can mine. So, and I'm kind of wondering, well, what's his plan of action here? I mean, is he going to beach the boat and then run, which some people do, you know? Anyway, we go on for a couple of miles, and then he points his, and as I'm chasing him, he's got a woman in the boat with him, and she's turned around looking over his shoulders at me. And I'm giving the high sign. I'm giving this sign where I slice my hand across my throat for her to stop, for get him to stop. And she just looks at me. Her hair is all frizzled and blown back across her face. And she's just ignoring me. And he glances back at me once or twice, and I'm pointing at him. I got the blue lights and the siren going. So then suddenly he points the boat right into the shore, and this is just pure cypress trees. And I'm thinking, well, this is almost a suicide act. And then he disappears. And where he disappeared into was a very small creek, about double the width of a boat. And I'm thinking, oh my, this is the real deal now. And so, because this was that low water, and this creek is probably only a couple of feet deep. There's stumps, there's logs, there's stobs, there's trees blown down across it. It's as bad as you can get, because now we're out of the main water body of the Okawaha. So I thought to myself, well, I'm going to give it a go. I said, well, I'll do the best I can, and eventually I'm going to reach a point where my boat just can't get through it. It'll pinch down, if you can imagine. So I back off the throttle, and I follow his kicker trail, his bubble trail in. We make a right-hand turn, and I can just see his transom disappear as he flared up to go around the next turn ahead of me. And then I saw a cypress tree, and it had fallen down to the water, and at its base there was about maybe a foot and a half of water across the base of this tree, maybe just 5 or 6 foot wide, that I had to get across in order to keep going. And so I hit it, and when I hit it, the boat starts shuddering real bad. And I'm thinking, well, I've got a bent prop shaft. Now I'm down to about 20 miles an hour because we're real narrow. So I come around the next bend, and I see him, and he throws something out of the boat. I see something white come out of the boat and land in the water. Don't know what it is. I just make a mental note as I'm chasing him that I need to come back and find whatever that was. And so now we continue on. We've got a few more straightaways, a few more bends we run through, and then there are three cypress trees. These are big trees that have been blown down, laying down, crossing the creek. And where the root ball is in the trunk, it has sunk beneath the water, so there's maybe a 6 foot wide patch of water there. I'm going to guess maybe a foot or two deep. I can't make it in my boat. Impossible. But I watch him flare his boat up on his side and run right around across the top of him, no problem. I can see the spray going up on the bank, and he goes on up the creek. In my mind, there's only one way I can possibly make this work. I need to run my boat up onto the trees, the side of my hull up on the trees, flare it. I need to bring the whole boat out of the water, run it around the top of these trees, and hope I can drop off on the other side. And I don't know if I'm making sense, but I'm going to try to roll the boat up on its side so the prop doesn't hit the trees, and let it ring it, come around, and then drop in. That's what I'm going to try to do.
This sounds crazy.
Well, so I hit these trees, and now I'm going, and of course I'm going probably 15 miles an hour now. The speed's dropping, you know, but I'm trying to get the timing just right. I'm trying to get it so I can pull this off. Well, the boat runs up on the trees. It goes higher and higher and higher. And then I come to a very soft stop, and I'm out of the water. About the water 6 feet below me, my boat is in the trees. I'm stuck. And so the bad guy is somewhere down the creek. And so now the propeller is free spinning, and so I shut it, and it's just making this horrible racket. And I shut it off, And I take a moment because I've got about 200 or 300 spiders on me. I've run through all these spiders, through all these limbs have been slapping me, and the boat is full of leaf litter, and there's spiders everywhere. These are non-biting spiders. We call them little marsh spiders, but it's not a big deal. But I took a moment to knock all of them off of me. And at first, I couldn't see him. So I crawl up, I monkey crawl up the tree. I take one of these three cypress and I monkey crawl up it, just like the guy does when he's doing the coconut thing you see in the movies and everything. And I get about 15 feet above the ground, and through the leaves of some of the branches, there are some sweet gum trees in front of me. I can just see his boat, and he stopped dead in the water. And what had happened was he went about another 75 to 100 yards, and there was a tremendous log jam that blocked the whole creek. And now he's trapped. And so I sit there for a moment, and I'm looking at him. I'm thinking, well, now, I said, I still got a chance to catch him if I can keep him in that boat. I got to convince him he needs to stay in that boat, because I know he's going to paddle over there. The next thing that's going to occur in his mind, he's going to beach that boat, and he's going to run through that swamp. And this is the kind of swamp you really don't want to chase somebody through. So, because this is big. I mean, these swamps in the Oklawaha River are a thick carpet of poison ivy, from one end to the other. Everything you see green up to about 3 or 4 feet is poison ivy. So, and so if you're allergic to it like I am, that kind of, gives you some second thoughts. But anyway, so I'm up there on top of this tree, and I start giving him orders. I'm shouting at him at the top of my lungs, and of course I'm throwing out a few choice expletives as we go along, trying to get his attention. And he's looking up at me, and so finally he says, yeah, I hear you. I says, will you stay in that boat, or I'm going to shoot you if you try to leave that boat. Of course I wasn't going to shoot him, but I'm just trying to do a bluff on him. So he says, finally, don't shoot me, I'll stay here. I said, great. And so now, I get hold of one of the limbs that are pointed to the ground, and I kind of grab it, and kind of like a fire pole, I just kind of shimmy down it. When I was about 5 foot off the ground, I just let go. And when I let go, I landed in mud, went to about waist deep, and all this methane gas, this putrid gas, just burst out of the swamp. I don't know if you've ever been in a swamp like that, but the methane bubbles and pops. And so then I have to waller out of this mud and up to some cypress trees where I can get up on top of the and root balls. And then I can kind of step, play hopscotch from one root ball to the next, and eventually make my way up to him. And also, while I was doing this, I saw him throw a couple of gigs out of the boat, which is kind of like a harpoon, but it has multiple tines on it, or spears. And so I get up to him, and of course I tell him he's under arrest for fleeing and attempting to elude, which is a third-degree felony in the state of Florida. And so...
What's the third-degree felony?
Fleeing and attempting to elude from a law enforcement officer on the water is a third-degree felony in the state of Florida, punishable by up to 5 years in prison or a $5,000 fine. Also, the boat is eligible for forfeiture. So I have him paddle over to me, and I start... Well, before I had him paddle over to me, I said, what did you just throw in the water? He said, I threw some gigs in there. I said, I see you have a diving mask in your boat. You put that mask on. I said, you go back down there and you get those gigs. He says, well, the water's not very clear here. I'm worried about getting bit by an alligator. I said, I don't care if you are or not. I says, you get those goggles on and you dive down there and get those gigs. So anyway, he did that, brought the gigs back up on the boat, and then I had him paddle over to me. And so I check him out. He doesn't have any weapons or firearms in the boat. And we have the gigs. And so then I said, well, what's the deal here? I said, well, why are you running? He said, well, I threw that bass out of the water back there, because I had asked him, it was about a 7-pound bass he gigged, which is also illegal. They can only be caught with hook and line. And I'm thinking to myself, though, really, I said, this is pretty extreme to be running just for a bass. But anyway, I had no radio contact. So this is a dead zone. And so I can't really check him out until I get him to land, get him somewhere where I can run a background check for warrants on, and also the boat, see what's up with that. But I also realize I can't put him in handcuffs now, because I still need his help. I need his help to get my boat off the tree. So I put them, the man and the woman, in the bow, and I operate his boat. I drive it back up to the cypress trees, and now I'm looking up at the bottom of my boat. and one of the propeller blades had broken off. That's what had caused the shuttering when I hit that tree. And that was supposed to be a propeller that, when we bought it from the manufacturer, that was impossible to break the blade. But anyway, so I told him, here's the deal. I said, you know, of course, you're under arrest, but I'm going to need your help to get that boat out of that tree. And then he's telling me, you mean to tell me you're arresting me? You want my help? I said, yeah. I said, you might as well go ahead and get it over with. And, of course, his wife is telling me, I said, just go ahead and do it, sweetheart. Just do it and get it over with so we can get the blankety-blank out of here. And so so he crawls on up there with me, and we give the boat a good shove, and it doesn't come off. And then we really have to bear down it with both of us. We shove it off because it's kind of hooked on a knob or some limbs underneath it that were sticking out from the tree. Anyway, we roll it off, and it slides down the trees, and with a big kersplash, it lands in the water. And I can't drive my boat on a plane now. I can only idle it. I put him in my boat, I handcuff him, and I ask her, I says, can you drive this boat, which was probably a stupid question. She said, oh, yeah, I can drive a boat. And I said, I imagine. So anyway, we both drove in kind of a slow convoy back up to the boat ramp where now I could get dispatched on the radio, and I had some other officers come down and had him carted off to jail. And when we checked the engine out, we find out that the engine is stolen. So maybe that's why he was fleeing from me. I don't know, but I just thought that was that's one of the more interesting boat chases. I've had some really, really good ones, but I always like to tell that one because it's kind of rare that you end up in a tree still are able. By complete happenstance and good luck, I will admit that the logjam just happened to be down there that stopped him or prevented him from going any farther. So there you go. There's one boat chase.
And what was he ultimately charged with?
He was charged with the felony fleeing, attempting to elude. I charged him, he and her for possession of the illegal fish, showing that the time marks where it had been gigged, which is a misdemeanor, and also charged him with, I was able to charge him with changing out the plate numbers, the serial numbers on the engine. I could not charge him with a stolen boat motor because of some technicalities I don't want to bore the listeners with, but it had been stolen about a year before. And you really can't charge somebody with theft of the motor unless they admit to it, which you wouldn't. You can only charge somebody with theft of, say, an outboard motor if it had been recently stolen, 2 to 3 weeks when it's fresh. But a year, I mean, he could say that he might have bought, you know, he could have bought that from somebody else, is what I'm trying to share, unless he confessed to it, which he did not. So, but that's the gist of it. And then the stolen outboard was returned to the owner, who happened to live in Palatka. Matter of fact, he was a lieutenant who taught ROCT at one of the high schools. Huh. He was quite happy to get his kicker back.
And then I know you had an interesting case involving monkey fishing, and that was the first I've ever heard of it, and you mentioned it earlier in our conversation, and I'd love for you to tell me, what is monkey fishing and what's the problem with it to start
with? Well, monkey fishing, and it started back in, as best I can tell, because I've done quite a bit of research and I've written about it, several stories, back in the 50s. Somebody got it in their mind that they would take off the magneto, remove the magneto from one of these antique telephones, and of course, you know, it had the old handle that you had to spin to generate the charge, and attach that to a board and a couple of wires. Well, when they did that and they spun it by hand, somehow they figured out it created a shock, and catfish would come up to the surface, and they could dip them up with dip nets and catch them and sell them. Well, as time went on, they improved that device. They still use the magneto, but they took off the old hand-turn handle and they attached a shaft to a small electric motor. And that motor was hooked up to a very big battery. Two wires came out of the magneto and were dropped over opposite sides of the boat, off the gunwales of the boat, down into the water, so they just dragged above the bottom with the copper tips peeled back so they're bare. And so when this machine was turned on, it would generate a very high voltage, but I think a very low amperage, something like 20,000 volts. I'm not an electrician, so I excuse me for not being able to explain it very well, but that's kind of the gist of it. And it only affects catfish, slick-skinned catfish. It is not powerful enough to affect game fish. But the taking of any species by electricity is illegal, and if you were to turn everybody out and allow them to do it, I can promise you right now, in these economic times, the St. John's River would be covered up from boats with one end to the other, because it's just too easy a way to catch fish during the summer months. Now, during the winter, you cannot catch it using this method because the shock does not work unless the water temperature is 70 degrees or above. So it's usually a summertime activity. But it was so prevalent at one time, I talked to some of the old game wardens who retired before me, that at night it would be a city of lights. There would be 80 to 100 boats at night on the river fishing. And then back then, and even when I first came, there was no law regarding fleeing and attempting to elude on the water. So in my early years, when you had a boat chase with somebody, if you couldn't catch them with the device, you had nothing to charge them with. So as a result, you'd end up stopping them after a couple-mile boat chase, and they'd sit there and offer you a sandwich and a cup of coffee if you didn't catch them, and then you start all over again and try it again. And you try to get it to where you can throw a throw buoy on top of the electric device that they threw out of the boat, which sinks like a car. It weighs about 10 pounds, and it sinks rather quickly. So it was kind of a crazy time, but that's kind of the gist of it. I found it to be, because these guys are really good. They're very, very good at what they do. They were raised on the river. They drove boats since they were 5 years old, sitting in their daddy's lap. They knew every nook and cranny. They had the river memorized above the water line, and they had it memorized below the surface of the water. They knew all the obstructions. They knew it all. So chasing these guys was quite a challenge, because they knew where they were going. 3 o'clock in the morning, or even in broad daylight. I mean, it was.
And it was usually done at night or during the day? At night, just for hiding?
Most often, it was done at night. But I had several dealings with them in the daytime as well. They go up these side creeks like the Okawaha, which is a favorite place to go, because in the late spring, early summer, that's the spawning run for the channel cats and the white cats. And so they make that run, just a gazillion of them come up those creeks to spawn. Commercial fishermen know that, and so they'll go up there and try to electrocute them in the spawning areas. And by the way, no traps or nets are allowed to be run in any of the tributaries either, for that same reason, because that's where the fish go to spawn.
Okay. And when was the law for fleeing and attempting to elude passed?
That was in the around the mid 80s. Probably a couple of years before I had the boat chase that I just relayed the story to you of. And once that went into effect, that pretty well cinched it. They didn't want any part of a third-degree felony, they being the commercial fishermen. And so that brought monkey fishing to a halt. And since then, you know, maybe every 3 or 4 years, one of the guys will make a monkey fishing case on the river. And a lot of times it's just a recreational fisherman just out there trying his luck, and he gets caught at it. So it's something that doesn't really happen anymore, nor does a lot of the other commercial fishing activity we had where they were moving large quantities of freshwater game fish like speckled perch out of hoop nets, and they'd have a really good bootleg market for them and sell them. So a lot of that has stopped on the river. However, on the hill, or what we call land, here in Putnam County, is still an extremely rich target-rich environment. It's a good place to go to catch a poacher.
Now, who was the most notorious poacher that you encountered?
The most notorious poacher in Putnam County, his name is Roger Gunter. Right now, Roger's about 72 years old. I have had several dealings with him. All the guys have had dealings with him. He's a throwback to another time. He should have lived 200 years ago. That's the kind of guy he is. He was raised on Rice Creek, which is a little tributary north of Palaca, and flows into the Okawaha. They had a little house there, on a patch of high ground in a swamp, and that's where he was raised. Didn't have a real good. His daddy was kind of a mean man. Matter of fact, he ended up shooting his daddy when he was 9 years old. That's after his mother tried to shoot him but missed. So, because he'd come home and he'd be drunk and he'd shoot up the house with a .38, and on this one particular day he thought he was going to kill his mama, so he ended up shooting him, and they hauled his daddy off to jail. So, that's just a beginner or starter piece for him. But he was a kid. He would go out and catch what he calls pot gut minnows, and he'd catch a bunch of them. He'd take them up to the hardware store and sell them for half a penny a piece, and there he'd get enough money to buy a box of .22 caliber shells, and then he'd take that and he'd go squirrel hunting. And he'd get squirrels for the family, and they shoot ducks. And He ended up going to the military. He was with the 82nd Airborne. He boxed in the military. He competed in parachuting. When he got out of the military, the first thing he did was start gator hunting. He was in with some boys that were selling gators. The hide market was pretty good back then. And he was going great guns on that. As a matter of fact, he told me he had a bunch of hides salted and ready to go for sale, and then a bunch of his buddies got caught in Georgia by the feds, and he stopped right there. He said, I backed off of it right then. He said, I just stopped it. And that's the way he does. If he even senses that something's going to go wrong, he won't take the chance. He'll just back away from it and do something else. And what he ended up doing was his father-in-law, his first wife, taught him how to make this monkey machine, this electric shocking device. And once he got the hang of that, now his daddy, Roger's daddy, was a superb mechanic. He could make anything with his hands, and he taught Roger to do the same. So when Roger got to making those monkey machines, they were just primo. And he started doing that, and like he told me, I've had four interviews with him for about 6 hours of recorded time. He told me that out of everything he's done, monkey fishing is still the most fun thing. He said there's just nothing better than seeing those fish come up and jumping or skipping across the surface and dipping them up. He said there's nothing better than doing that. As a matter of fact, one time he told me, he says, I was sitting at a bar up in Palak, and he said, I had a good-looking blonde on either side of me, and I'm sitting there sipping a Budweiser. He says, I got to thinking about juicing those fish, which means electrocute him. He says, he calls me Cat. He calls everybody Cat because that way he doesn't have to remember his name. He says to me, Cat, he said, I couldn't stand it. He said, I had to jump up right then and go. I had to get me some fish. So he leaves two blondes and a Budweiser and then out there to go get some fish. But some of the boat chases that the officers have been in with him are absolutely legend. I mean, I've had some really dicey boat chases with him, but my sergeant and another officer had a boat chase with him that went from Sanford on the St. John's River all the way into the south end of Lake George, about a 50-minute boat chase. And eventually Roger and the other guy lost the officers in Lake George. I'm not quite sure why, but in the course of the boat chase, Roger and the other fellow threw every fish they had, every catfish, at the officers. They took off their T-shirts, threw it behind them, hoping to get caught up in their prop. They ran through shiner lift nets. They ran through old burnout pilings from houses on the river. Now, they're running black without lights, Roger and his guy is, and the officers are chasing them with a spotlight on. And during that chase, they went through a shiner lift net, which is a, for your listeners out there, I'm going to try to explain it. It's four poles that come out of the water, and on the corner, top corner of each pole is a pulley. And a line comes from a pulley to a square net about 12 foot by 12 foot. And these nets are used to catch shiners, but when they're drawn up, and these are fairly heavy lines, you don't want to hit them with a boat going 60 miles an hour. Well, that's what happened, and part of the net got into his buddy's face and tore half his face off during the chase. So afterwards, Gunner told me, he said, yeah, I had to take him over and have him get him stitched up. He says he was a heck of a mess, but because it peeled half his face back. So just some really good, interesting times with Roger. But getting toward the end of my career, and, of course, I like I had told you earlier, Laura, in one of our telephone conversations, you know, I wanted to start doing some writing, and I thought he would make a really good subject. So about 5 years before I retired, I asked Roger, I said, what about it? I said, about letting me interview you. He said, no way, Cat, no way. He says, I got too many secrets. I said, what are you talking about? You're in your early 60s. You're going to die eventually. I said, you might as well give them up. No, I'm not going to do it. Year after year, I'd come back to him, and he'd give me the same answer. And his wife's name is Sharon. She worked in the same school administration building as my wife did. My wife is in administration up there in the school system. So my wife and she would talk, and Sharon really wanted me to write a story on Roger. And she'd keep trying to talk Roger into it. Well, anyway, about a month before I retired, after this five-year quest, Roger finally says, okay, you can interview me, but only after you're retired. You can't come over to my house till after you're retired. I said, okay. So about a month after I retired, I go over there, and I've got my recorder. And I, sure enough, we did the deal, and I came back three more times, actually. Got a lot of neat pictures of him, and he told me everything he had done. And it was a lot. I mean, he's a wild man, absolute wild man.
And was he, you know, had the statute of limitations run out on his deeds so that
that was the first question he asked. He says, now if I tell you all these things, am I going to get in trouble? I said, no, because actually you are correct. The statute of limitations was up on all of them. So no matter what he told me, he couldn't get in trouble for it. And of course, you know, as you probably know, even whatever he did tell me, you still got to have evidence to corroborate it or back it up. Just because somebody tells you something doesn't mean you can charge them with it. You still have to have some sort of physical evidence or corroborative evidence to back it up before you can actually, you know, charge somebody with a crime. But anyway, regardless of that, the statute of limitations had expired for all of his bad deeds. And so he felt really comfortable in sharing, you know, what he had done with me. One of the interesting things for your readers is, I mean, I'm sure they've seen people wrestle alligators on the hill or on land, but what Roger used to do just for grins was he would free dive the Ocklawaha River, free dive meaning you don't have a scuba tank, and he'd dive down and he'd grab hold of a big gator on the bottom just for fun, just to see how long he could hold on. And he'd be telling me about those stories and about one gator that actually tried to get after him, about 11.5-foot gator, and how he has this technique for how to do when a gator's after you. You've got to dive down beneath him and come up behind him. But then he tells me, he says, now the 6 to 7 footers aren't too bad, but you always get your T-shirt torn up because they're snapping and biting at you all the time, Cat, if you can understand what I'm saying. This is kind of how he talks. But it's a hoot listening to him tell about it. He almost died from the bends. He's a deep sea diver, and he was running out of air at about 110 foot out in the Atlantic, and he was under the hull of a ship, and he saw one more grouper he wanted to kill. And he told me, he says, Cat, I just had to kill that grouper. I just had to shoot him. I knew I was running low on air, but I had to kill him. And he killed the grouper and tied him off to a stringer, and about 60 feet, he ran out of air. Well, the short of that story is he got the bends real bad, almost killed him, and to this day, he tells me, you can stick a pin right through either of my legs, and I can't feel a thing. So, because I had to put him in a hyperbaric chamber twice to get him right. Those kind of stories go on and on with Roger. So he's just a very interesting character, and like I said, he's a throwback to another time and a lot of fun to talk to. So.
And was he ever convicted on a wildlife-related charge?
He was never caught monkey fishing. He had many boat chases with a lot of guys, never caught. He was caught probably a half a dozen times for game violations, deer, ducks, that sort of thing. And one of the officers that used to work for me is the one who caught him those many times, and his name is Tommy Shear. But nothing would happen to him, Laura. I mean, everybody liked him because he's this figure like this. Even the judges and the lawyers, they all loved Roger because he was like this character from another time, you know. And so whenever he came up there, at the most, he'd be fined probably a couple $100, if that. And a lot of times he kind of skated, you know, they just kind of let him go with a wink and a nod. But that was back then, and this is now. If those same things had occurred and he'd go to court, he'd probably get slapped a little harsher.
What was it like interviewing him after spending so many years chasing him?
Well, it was interesting because I got the backstory. I got the story on the other side. What he was doing, I knew what I was doing, but I was wondering what he was doing. For instance, if he's in a boat and I'm chasing him, what's he thinking? What's he doing? And it wasn't always what I thought he was doing. For instance, I thought one night I'm chasing him, I got another officer behind me. This is 4:30 in the morning, and he's driving an extremely fast boat, and we are neck and neck. I can't gain on him, and he can't gain on me. And I've got the faster boat, and my officer behind me has got a slightly slower boat. And at times I'm so close to him that the spray is coming up into my nose, and you can taste that bitter taste of burnt boat motor oil, you know, and that's getting shoved up on my nostrils, you know, as I'm chasing him. So that's how close and real it was. But this chase lasted for quite a while. It was probably about a 10-mile chase. And as we're going along, he's making these big sweeping curves across from one side of the river to the other. Now, the river here is about a mile and a half wide, if you can picture it. And he's making these big, long sweeping curves, and I'm scratching my head. I'm kind of wondering, as I'm chasing him, Why is he doing this? And I thought it was a tactical thing to keep me in his bubble stream, because if you're in the bubble stream of a boat, it will slow you down about another mile and a half an hour That's why it's usually better to chase somebody if you're in the clean water off to the side of his wake. And I thought he was trying to keep me in his bubble trail to slow me down a mile and a half an hour. But when I talked to him about that, he says, no, that's not what I was doing. He said, I had to take my hands off the steering wheel. I was steering with my knees. He said, I had the monkey machine. I was wrapping up the wires, getting ready to throw it overboard if he came alongside. So while I'm chasing him, he's not driving the boat with his hands. He's just using it with his knees. He said, every time the shoreline came up, I'd reach up with one hand real quick and snatch the steering wheel, and I'd lock it with my knees, and then I keep wrapping the wires up. I just wanted to make sure when I threw the monkey machine or the electric shocking device that the wires wouldn't get hooked up in my prop, and that's why I wanted to roll. That's why he wanted to roll them up tight. So you see right there, that was kind of interesting. I hadn't, I had no way of knowing that unless I had spoken with him. And then as this particular chase proceeded, we come up to a pound net. Now, a pound net, this is going to be very hard to describe for your listeners because there's no other place like it in Florida that has one, I think. But this is a massive commercial fishing device that has a lead of webbing that runs out from the shore 200 feet. And there's pine, there's cypress stops that the net hangs off of in a line. And it comes to a pound, which is, I'm going to liken it to a fish corral made out of wooden timber and net and webbing, real thick net and webbing. And this fish corral goes all the way to the bottom, 15 to 20 feet deep, and rises above the water surface about 4 or 5 feet. You don't want to hit it at high speed. Anyway, I know this pound net's coming up, and in my mind, I know Roger's going to try to put me into the net. And so, but things were going along pretty good, and then all of a sudden he makes a sharp turn and goes over toward the shoreline with his boat. And I see him running along the cattails. And I'm thinking, well, the pound net isn't here yet. It's still another mile or two ahead, and I'm okay. But then I took my light off of him, and I whipped it ahead, and there was the net. I was heading right for the lead. Well, that's not the pound portion. That's not the bad part. But still, you got to pay attention because you don't want to hit one of the poles. So, excuse me. I had to keep my light on so I would cut through the net with my boat prop and not hit one of the poles, which I did. It took about 2 seconds. Once I was through the net, I whipped my light back over to the left, and he was gone. And we had spread apart too far, and I lost visual of him right then. The short of that story is I lost him. And so I came back to my officer who was behind me. He ran into the pound portion of the net. He's running black behind me and without lights, and he hits the pound portion of the net. But he had seen it coming up at the last minute and was able to pull back on the throttle and duck because all the poles went across and broke his windshield. And when I got back to him, these big cypress poles were all busting his boat. And of course, he says, you know, to me, I thought you knew you were going, Sergeant. And I said, well, so did I, but apparently not, you know. But so when I interview Roger, I said, well, what about the pound net? He says, Cat, I didn't know where I was at either. He says, I just knew it was coming up somewhere. He says, when I went over to the shoreline, I hit one of the poles that broke apart and hit me, smacked me right in the top of the head and almost knocked me out. He says, I could see your light back behind me. And so then he said to me, I'm just going to cut hard right, which means he swung across the whole river about 2 miles to the opposite shoreline, and then he headed back in the direction he had come from. And then as he's telling me this, he says, he backed down to about 50 miles an hour, and he said he keeps looking behind him, and he's still running black. He's running without lights. And he says, I was looking behind me, and so he says, at one point, I looked behind me, and then I turned back to look in front of me, and then he said, well, he used some choice expletives, but there's a massive dock right in front of him, about 300 foot long. And by pure chance, or good luck for him, there was an opening where there weren't any pylons. He said, Cat, he said, I just hunched down, and I shot right through it. He said, I didn't realize till later what had happened. They were repairing some of the pylons on that dock, and they had taken those out, and that was the gap he shot through. Other than that, he would have creamed himself. And then, just before he's getting back to where he's going to get to his boat trailer, he runs out of gas in the middle of the river. And then he's thinking to himself, oh, my God, they're going to come right back this way. I'm stuck out here in the middle of the river, and the sun's fixing to come up in just a few minutes, you see. And so he jumps up on his boat, and he jiggles back and forth, hoping he get a few drops of gas back in, and he gets just enough gas back in the engine where he can idle it up a little creek and park the boat and hide there, and then walk out and get some help. So Anyway, so that's Roger Gunner. But those sort of stories about him are just legends in this county, and it just goes on and on. It's great fun to talk about it because, like I said, there's really not too many people left like him anymore.
And you're actually in the process of writing a book about your experiences.
That is true. I'm at the tail end of it, I am proud to say. It's been about a 3-year effort. And I do plan to, I think I'm going to try to submit it very shortly. But I've only got a couple of chapters left, and of course Roger plays a big part in the book. I've got him in there for about 3 chapters. One's a deer case where I almost got killed in that too, where we're trying to run him down, and then we had this monkey fishing case. And then actually I plan to have one chapter about the interview I had with him. Now that story is already published in Folio Weekly, but it's kind of a neat story, I think, and I'm hoping to include that in the book as well. But I've got stories in there that are kind of humorous. I try to point the finger at myself, a little self-deprecating humor, and so that the reader, when they read this, hopefully they'll get a chuckle or two out of it along the way. But my goal in writing this is for, well, to be honest with you, I'm hoping that for the folks out there who are armchair adventurers, that they can, I want to help them find their inner caveman or woman, as the case may be, by reading these chapters, because when I write them, I try to put it in scene. In other words, I want the reader to feel like they're right off my elbow, or they're sitting in the seat of that boat with me when we're on this boat chase, or we're chasing somebody through the woods on foot at night, or whatever the situation is. My goal is to make them feel it. So, and I hope that they do. I hope they enjoy it.
Well, you're a great storyteller, and I'll have a link to your article about your interview with Roger Guntner, and which is just very quick read, and I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me today.
Well, I have enjoyed it very much.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about the adventures of a state game warden with Bob Lee, a veteran wildlife law enforcement officer from Florida.
Edited transcripts of selected programs are available on my website, laurelnemi.com, and also on mongabay.com. That's mongabay.com. You can also find archived episodes of The Wildlife on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Wildlife can also be heard on the Animal Wise Radio Network, which is available nationally and internationally and is broadcast to any mobile internet device via Live 365, a 24/7 radio network. Of course, if you have any comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP in Burlington, Vermont.